production running weekly on Thursday, Friday, Saturdays, and Sundays until November 11th at the Milagro Theater in Portland. Alebrijes is a family-friendly production of real-life artist and Alebrijes creator Pedro Linares, delves into his world and fictionalizes it to create this Dia de los Muertos story. Full of mythical creatures, psychedelic jungles, song, dance, and larger-than-life puppetry. Again, that's Alebrijes, the Milagro Theater annual Dia de los Muertos theater production running weekly on Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sundays until November 11th at the Milagro Theater, 525 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And you're listening to KBOO, listener-supported community radio in Portland, and KBOO Portland. And Wednesday Morning Talk Radio is up next.
Herb Spear is wagging his finger. Carbox is scratching his head. They ought to be shooting the bankers, but they're giving them money instead. The pleb should be storming the ramparts and whetting the guillotine's blade, singing, capitalism's in crisis, so where are the barricades? Why don't they close down the city and throw all the gamblers in jail? But they're still making money, make money, as they slice up the future for sale. And Sir Numbskull still hugging his bonus. Lord Grab has made off with the loot. And the slick city traders, the corporate raiders, freebooters and fraudsters, hedge fund speculators, the stock market scammers, brain dead regulators, why aren't they all getting the boot? See how the bubbles are bursting, all that's solid melts into air. The stairs are beginning to rattle, and the rats are beginning to stare. There are cracks in the walls and the ceiling, and smoke's pouring out the front door. But the creme de la creme are all betting that the flames never reach the top floor. They tell us that cuts are essential to keep this rust bucket afloat. But nobody seems to be asking, why don't we just scupper the boat? They say we're all in this together, just like we were in the war. And in time the wheels will start turning again, and we'll all carry on as before. At last I see workers protesting, but there isn't a red flag in sight. And where are the banners proclaiming, workers of the world must unite? Do they call for the heads of the bosses, sing for capitalism's last days? Or is it British jobs for British workers? What nincompoop thought up that phrase? We're pissed off, of course, and we're angry, but revolution is not really us. Give us football and Strictly Come Dancing, and we won't make too much of a fuss. Give us someone to trust and to lead us, who knows the way out of this maze, so we can go on consuming forever, or at least till the end of our days. Suit. Carbox looks cool in his shades. Yes, capitalism's in crisis, my dear, but where are the barricades? Where are the barricades?
Ah, yes, the plaintive question of the great English singer-songwriter. Where are the barricades? Where are the barricades? Has anybody out there been behind some barricades? I have. A couple times in my life. Pretty exciting. like to see more of it. My name is Paul Rowan. This is a Wednesday Talk Radio. We are talking about authoritarian capitalism. Will it trump everything? Will we in extremis find ways to resist in the way that we need to? These are the questions I am posing this morning. You are invited to call in at 503-231-8187. I must confess, I actually had a whole program planned out with a guest. And then I kind of, I don't know, it was a little heavy for me. I don't know, maybe I should have kept going with it, but it was going to be a Halloween-themed show. Let's see, I was calling it It Came From the Deep, The Zombie Methane Apocalypse. And I had lined up Paul Beckwith, the rapid climate change expert from Canada, who I've had on two or three times to talk about similar theme. And I don't know, everything's just so heavy right now. There's an intensity that we're all feeling, I think, that, there's kind of, you know, I was trying to sort of make a joke on Halloween, and obviously it wasn't going to be a funny show because you can't talk about the disappearing Arctic ice and the warming ocean temperatures and the looming threat of the methane hydrate crystals melting under the seabed, especially on the East Siberian Arctic Shelf, which apparently, if one credits the very rarefied science which studies paleoclimatology and says that this has happened in the past with very incredibly rapid, beyond anything that we can really conceive, a pulse methane, release of methane, a huge pulse of gigatons. I think that's thousands of tons, maybe more, anyway, of methane from not just the East Siberian. That's the shallowest. It's, 50 to 100 meters, which is why it's going off. You know, it's already bubbling to the surface, but the idea is that once the temperature, ocean temperature, reaches a certain point, that there'll be a massive release, which will send this huge pulse of methane into the atmosphere, which then converts fairly rapidly into carbon dioxide and then adds to the vast store of carbon dioxide, which is already rapidly warming and destabilizing our climate. Anyway, talking about all that in the face of what's going on with this masculinist, white nationalist, hate killings and madness that's going on, stoked by the Trump phenomenon. Anywho, it was just a little daunting to me, so I backed off on that. But as you can see, I am talking about it anyway. So what I wanted to do, what I've tried to do with this show is attempt in my own little way, I hope it provides some use and cause for reflection to at least some listeners, to provide some deeper context so that we can have some kind of common language. Not that I'm providing it, obviously I can't provide it, but I'm hoping to contribute to having some kind of common context and language for understanding the actuality of what's going on. And so there's, many aspects to it intersectionally that we could, talk about. I see, for me, sort of the most at the forefront for me are, of course, the climate crisis, which is just basically the most extreme cutting edge of cumulative impact in ecology, a cumulative impact of various sources of pollution or disturbance of the environment that create these feedback loops. And intersect and cause something much greater than each individual action. So each, you know, each car, each factory, each burning of fossil fuels adds to this, what's going into the climate. And the climate system is so utterly complex that only, unfortunately, climate scientists and these very sophisticated computer models are able to approach an understanding in real time what is going on. So and if you give credence to those cutting edge climate scientists like Paul Beckwith and others, James Lovelock, the Arctic sea ice expert who I've had on, whose name eludes me at the moment. Anyway, and even the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change seems to be coming up to speed. If you credit them, then things are happening much, much, much faster than we thought even 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago. And they're just starting to, as I say, catch up with their, to some extent, with their models and real-time observations as to what's going on. So that's, you know, one. And then the other is the xenophobic, masculinist, white nationalist, white supremacist neo-fascism, which is spreading all too rapidly in various corners of the globe, including right here in the United States. And at a time when, as I said, there is an absolute and urgent need for global cooperation to rein in the fossil fuel burning, which is rapidly destabilizing our climate system. Instead, so many of these nation states are going instead in the opposite direction towards worse, more authoritarian forms of industrial capitalism, which is, of course, the cause of the crisis. And not just, if you heard Democracy Now!, there's, you know, not just the recent UN report saying that things are happening much, much faster than we thought, and, you know, adding to other studies that have been coming out in the past year or two. There's also studies about the loss of forms of life that have taken millions of years to evolve on this precious little planet in this corner of the universe here. And so I think these things are related. So I'm going to read some articles. I've got some articles listed on my program page for this site under, for this program, Wednesday Talk Radio, Authoritarian Capitalism Trumps Everything, from Neo-Fascist Resurgence to Regulatory Rollback by Way of Rabid White Nationalism, the Bloody Thirst for Profits Has Fueled a Triumphant Return of No-Holds-Barred Capitalism. And so I'm going to just give you the titles first. You can look them up on your own or just go to that website. The first one I'm going to read from is How Capitalism Stokes the Far Right and Climate Catastrophe, which just came out yesterday on Truth Out by Mark Bray. Another one came out September 16th by Kevin Rudd, former Prime Minister of Australia. It's a very different take. It sort of gives us a way out towards a still a kinder, gentler form of capitalism. Anyway, it's called The Rise of Authoritarian Capitalism, was an op-ed piece in the New York Times from yesterday. Is Capitalism a Threat to Democracy? From The New Yorker, May 14 of this year. And then we've got from last year, from 2016, before the election, a prescient piece, Trump's Popularity and the Rise of Authoritarian Capitalism, also in Truth Out by Jamil Kader, K-H-A-D-E-R, however you pronounce that. I think I may have discussed that on a previous program. Anyway, I think it would behoove us, perhaps, for us all to read some of the same things and try to come to a common understanding. I know, you know, what we really are deeply in need of is greater empathy and sort of getting back to a heart place, but we also have minds, and we perhaps need to shake ourselves out of our own sort of perhaps limited frameworks and challenge ourselves to what I say is maybe understand what's really going on that may not correspond to how you actually see the world. I've framed this in various ways over the years, liberalism versus radicalism, reform versus revolution. Anyway, I'm going to stop talking. The number to call in is 503-231-8187. I'm not going to stop talking. I'm going to stop improvising. I'm going to read from How Capitalism Stokes the Far Right and Climate Catastrophe. Capitalist competition and manufactured scarcity have provided the fuel for the growth of far-right politics. And another reason I'm doing this is because one of our other talk show hosts was challenged on their program to talk about whether capitalism itself is the root of the crisis. And I thought they had an opportunity to confront that forthrightly and actually backed off and did say that, there's welfare state capitalism. So my proposal is that no, there's an inherent dynamic to capitalism itself that leads it. In fact, it was born in authoritarianism and only because of its own internal crises was forced to adopt a kinder, gentler, welfare state form of capitalism, which we saw coming out of the Great Depression in the 1930s. But, if you lived in the late 19th century in a lot of American cities and worked in some of those factories, it wasn't very pretty. And that's the way a lot of the world still lives under capitalism. Anyway, here we go. We are living in ominous times. Every week, something new. White supremacist murders in Kentucky and Pittsburgh. The continued rise of the far right in Europe. Trump's attack on transgender rights. The election of aspiring tyrant Jair Bolsonaro to the Brazilian presidency, which you just heard about on Democracy Now! The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report that climate catastrophe is likely only about 20 years away. I would say it's here and much more imminent than 20 years. What's next? At a time when we should be uniting globally to reorganize our way of life to stave off climate disaster, many parts of the world are instead veering to the right, rejecting internationalism and demonizing marginalized communities. How did we get here? How can we escape annihilation? Crucial to answering these questions is understanding how the rise of the far right and the imminence of climate catastrophe are related threats. Most obviously, the far right promotes policies and perspectives that destroy the planet. Currently, the Trump administration is working hard to repeal Obama's environmental protection policies. Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte has lifted a moratorium on mining exploration while pushing a constitutional change that would enhance multinational exploitation of the resources of the Philippines. The newly elected Brazilian president, Bolsonaro, is poised to allow agribusiness free rein to cut down the Amazon. More fundamentally, fascist and far-right forces promote notions of ultranationalism and xenophobia that block the essential task of putting the interests of the planet and all of its inhabitants over those of any single group. Nationalism has fueled not only opposition to the European Union, but also rejection of the Paris Agreement and widespread climate denial among European far-right parties like UKIP, Front National, and the Sweden Democrats. The threat of the climate catastrophe is far more imminent and egregious in the global south, and white supremacy clearly discourages caring about most of the world. There are, quote, eco-fascists who co-opt the concept of bioregionalism to advance their genocidal politics, but their views do not have significant sway in actual far-right policy, and their, quote, environmental solution is not worthy of reasoned engagement. But our analysis cannot stop here. Centrist and even nominally leftist governments pursue anti-environmental policies. Major signatories to the Paris Agreement are not on pace to meet the agreement's goals. And even if they were, it would be too little too late. No, the roots of these crises extend much deeper. We must recognize that the climate crisis and the resurgence of the far right are two of the most acute symptoms of our failure to abolish capitalism. A capitalist system that prioritizes profit and perpetual growth over all else is the mortal enemy of global aspirations for a sustainable economy that satisfies needs rather than stock portfolios. Quote, green capitalism was touted as a compromise that could allow humanity to keep the planet and eat it too. But scientific data show that incremental adjustments of pollution standards and banning plastic straws cannot compensate for the destruction wrought by the 100 companies that produce 71% of global emissions. Far too often, efforts to reel in pollution or establish decent working conditions are derailed by the ability of multinational finance to either run roughshod over local laws or divest from countries or regions that challenge their profitability. We must recognize that the climate crisis and the resurgence of the far right are two of the most acute symptoms of our failure to abolish capitalism. Capitalist crisis, competition, and manufactured scarcity also provide essential fuel for the growth of fascist and far-right politics, especially when there is no viable left alternative. Early fascists and Nazi movements grew by exploiting economic insecurity during the Great Depression, while the left tore itself apart. In the 1970s, the fascist National Front took advantage of economic turmoil in the UK, and more recently, the emergence of parties like the fascist Golden Dawn in Greece owed a great deal to the 2008 financial crisis. In part, Bolsonaro rode to victory by harnessing popular disenchantment stemming from, quote, the worst recession since the return of democracy. In times of crisis, we can either look forward in solidarity or turn inward in xenophobic reactionary fear. Fascism and far-right politics harness and promote fears of difference and anxieties about joblessness and financial ruin when left alternatives falter. When avowedly socialist political parties in Greece or Brazil enacted brutal austerity measures, they opened the door for the far right. In the United States, Trump managed to capitalize on opposition to free trade policies that had become the hallmark of the Democratic Party. In a context of economic anxiety, Hillary Clinton's promise to, quote, put a lot of coal miners out of work, even if it was in the interest of saving the planet, played into the ability of the far right to generate support for Trump by taking advantage of the antagonism between working class livelihood and ecological sustainability that capitalism fosters. This next part is entitled System Change, Not Civility. Even the northern European welfare states that have avoided harsh austerity have failed to prevent the rise of the far right. In part, this stems from the rise of welfare chauvinism, the belief that welfare is beneficial but should not be extended to, quote, outsiders, which demonstrates the limitations of social democracy in one country, when such wealth is still produced by exploiting the resources and labor of the global South. Bolsonaro rode to victory by harnessing popular disenchantment stemming from, quote, the worst recession since the return of democracy. A very different analysis has been offered recently by centrist pundits and politicians in the U.S. who argue the underlying root of threats to our society emerge from the growth of extremism at the expense of moderation. When Cesar Sayoc mailed bombs to Democratic Party figures, Chuck Schumer echoed Trump's infamous both sides comments by arguing that, quote, despicable acts of violence and harassment are being carried out by radicals across the political spectrum. Shame on you, Chuck Schumer. To Rachel Maddow, Puerto Rican separatists and the KKK are both simply violent extremist groups. The policy of interning migrant children in concentration camps spurred less of a public debate about institutional racism than it did about the civility of those who confronted the policy's architects. Of course, this implicit argument that no policy is ever more heinous than the incivility of one who violates common decorum in protesting it paves the way for ascendant authoritarianism while curtailing the scope of resistance. Centrist discourse has abstracted white supremacy and anti-Semitism into hate, depoliticized fascism and anti-fascism by caricaturizing them as mirror images of extremism. And of course, we see the same thing here in Portland to some extent with our mayor and a police chief, and ignored what should be, that's my insert there, and ignored what should be one of the most important news stories, the fairly imminent destruction of the planet. The world is on fire. There is no time to be patient. If we don't abolish capitalism, capitalism will abolish us. And let me just repeat that I'm reading from How Capitalism Stokes the Far Right and Climate Catastrophe by Mark Bray, out on Truth Out yesterday, October 30th. Debates about reformism versus revolutionism have waged for generations on the left. But now we are on a deadline. Lesser evilism among capitalist politicians may have some rationale when spending 5 minutes casting a ballot on election day. But we don't have time for it to be a guiding strategical outlook. We need to organize movements to build popular power and shut down the industries that threaten our existence. Fascism is ascendant. The world is on fire. There's no time to be patient. I think I made a mistake in printing this out. I think they repeat some of these same sentences, but they're worth repeating. If we don't abolish capitalism, capitalism will abolish us. Since Donald Trump took office, progressive journalism has been under constant attack, and companies like Facebook and Google that change their policies to limit your access to sites like Truthout. The result is that our articles are reaching fewer people at a time when we need genuinely independent news more than ever. Here's how you can help. They do good work. Since Truthout doesn't run ads or take corporate or government money, we rely on our readers for support. By making a monthly or one-time donation of any amount, you'll help us publish and distribute stories that have a real impact on people's lives. Well, I think they deserve that little blurb. I guess that's the end of the article. Mark Bray is a historian of human rights, terrorism, and politics in modern Europe. He is the author of Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook, translating anarchy, the anarchism of Occupy Wall Street, and the co-editor of Anarchist Education and the Modern School, a Francisco Ferrer reader. He is currently a lecturer at Dartmouth College. Okay, so that's one, How Capitalism Stokes the Far Right and Climate Catastrophe. And again, 503-231-8187. I'm also going to read a little bit from a couple of these articles I have here, but we have our first caller. Go ahead, Sean, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning, Paul.
Good morning.
Long time no speak.
Yeah.
Hey, so a lot to talk about here, obviously, so I'll try to limit. But first, I want to, you started off, ironically, I was thinking about this already, but, in terms of methane, a lot gets talking about, carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, and so forth. But the fact is that one molecule of methane is 40 times more stronger, actually, than one molecule of CO2. So that says a hell of a lot about how we need to be concerned about the release of methane and how that ties into Bolsonaro down in Brazil, who, of course, wants to open up the Amazon, and a lot gets talking about, planting soybeans and whatnot. But, of course, cattle will also be a big part of that, which is a big contributor to methane. So that's just one piece of it. But as far as Portland and activism and so forth, people everywhere need to get a lot more involved. But I want to recommend a great documentary to anybody who's not heard of it that came out back in 2013 and was put out by an activist who was heavily involved in Portland one time. His name is Craig Rosebrough, and the documentary is called Greedy Lying Bastards. And he covers a lot of this great topic, a lot of these things about, who's controlling what and so forth. And actually, watching it, you can come to understand how Trump and Kavanaugh came to be. But he also covers that the warnings about climate change and so forth have been going on since the 40s and 50s, and how these things, of course, are just squashed by the media and powers that be. So I just wanted to recommend that.
Okay.
Yeah, but, things in terms of just strictly climate and fascism, you made the point earlier reading from Truthout that, part of the rise of fascism has to do with resources, of course. And I don't think there's any coincidence that the rise of fascism, which, by the way, now it just recently was put out that at least 50% now of the planet's ruling governments have now turned authoritarian. And I think you can make the correlation between that and that they know that more and more the resources that are left are to be fought over. They're limited, and the pressure that's coming down on climate change, and of course they don't want to change their ways. So the only way that they can take control of resources, which to me also includes taking control of culture and people in order to do that, is by taking a far-right authoritarian rule.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Indeed.
Yeah, so I don't think there's any coincidence in all of that. So anyway, just to finish off, I recommend anybody three fantastic books. There's a lot out there, but I believe everybody should read The History of the U.S. and Capitalists Around the World in Eduardo Galeano's book, Open Veins of Latin America. That's essential. I think Naomi Klein really brought this home a lot in Shock Doctrine, and Chalmers Johnson's book, Sorrow's Empire, is also a great one.
All right. Thank you for that.
Thanks for the program.
All right. And 503-231-8187. Let me just read from Wikipedia to define authoritarian capitalism, otherwise known as illiberal capitalism. I think authoritarian is much better. And not to be confused with state capitalism, is an economic system in which a free market economy exists alongside an authoritarian government. Within authoritarian capitalism, individual rights such as freedom of speech and religion are repressed, while economic rights such as private property and the function of market forces are maintained. There's a large degree of contention around the viability of authoritarian capitalism, with the viability of political repression alongside economic freedom being questioned in the long term. Well, as Keynes said, in the long run, we're all dead. But anyway, it's not a recent phenomenon. Throughout history, examples of authoritarian capitalism include Pinochet's reign in Chile, Suharto's New Order in Indonesia, and the People's Action Party's early administration in Singapore. During the First World War, the ideological divide between authoritarian and liberal regimes was significantly less pronounced. Both were aligned to capitalist economic models. Moreover, the Axis powers of World War II have been described as possessing totalitarian capitalist economic systems. You know, they say these far-right ignoramuses say, oh yeah, the Nazis were started out as socialists. Come on, they killed communists and socialists. They, you know, independent free trade unions were anathema. In fact, they made their own trade unions that were aligned with both the army and party and nation state, which were all one, and the economy, which was integrated within, which is fascism. Anyway, this is interesting. Educate yourself, authoritarian capitalism on Wikipedia. Let's see, we got a full slate of callers. Let's go right now to Harvey. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi, Paul. Well, you know, capitalism is, you know, we live in a world of duality, and capitalism is part of that. There's many, many wonderful things about capitalism.
Wait a second. okay, you got to respond, first of all, to my point that there are inherent dynamics. This is Marx's point. I don't know if you've read Marx, but that there are actually inherent contradictions propelling capitalism towards exactly what it's doing right now.
Uh-huh. Yes, like I say, it's a double-edged sword, and everyone's invested on a small or large level, but it could work both for us and against us. So
you're not responding to my point.
Which is?
Which is that capitalism is killing us, and it's capitalism that's killing us. It's not the good things it's doing are immensely overweighed. It's a double-edged sword. It's a Damocles sword that's over us, that's at our jugulars.
I agree with you, and my saying is, where's the profit in a burnt-out planet? I completely agree with you. But I think that it's going to end up as what I call a battle of the titans. And to give you an example of that, like insurance companies, they insure everybody. And in one of the problems is that climate destabilization is causing them to lose billions and billions, and as the world heats up, they're losing more and more money. At the same time, insurance companies finance the fossil fuel industry because every aspect of the fossil fuel industry, like for oil, the drilling, the transportation, the selling, the storage, they make money on every level, the pipelines. They don't like, generally, in the past, they haven't liked solar panels, and the banks too, because solar panels, once manufactured and put in place, they just turn the sunlight into electricity. So both the banks and the insurance companies who used to make a lot of money off the fossil fuels are losing out. But at the same time, the insurance companies are losing out because of the climate destabilization. So I think it's going to essentially have to be a battle of the titans where they have to weigh the good against the bad.
So basically, you're
against the law.
So the theory that you're promulgating is a theory that's been out there, is that there's actually, instead of the contradictions of capitalism leading to its demise through the rise of popular power and movements, revolutionary movements to take it down, you're saying that the tensions within capitalism, the various sectors of the capitalist economy, the tension between them will actually lead the system to reform itself is essentially, I think, where you're going with that.
Yes, it is. Like, for instance, New York City divested its retirement benefit fund, from which they were making a lot of money on in fossil fuels. They divested it and reinvested it in renewables, and I think that, say, Portland could do the same, and the people could divest personally from fossil fuel industry and invest in renewables, which are here and now. And so it's going to be, there's a lot of death and destruction that is involved in every change, because you're in a capitalist system, you're always goring somebody's ox, no matter who. So the thing is that those who are totally invested, like the fossil fuel industry, they're going to fight. You know, that's why I say that the Trump administration is a fully owned subsidiary of the fossil fuel industry. So that's the battle there, is to somehow make the switch with as little loss as possible. But again, it's going to be a struggle, and wars are fought over oil, like the Iraq war. It's just that's the way we are, that's the way it is. And I think that we can, again, make a personal effort by, say, buying an electric car, putting solar panels on our roofs, plugging our car into the sun. Every little bit helps. And to just go, oh me, oh my, that it's all going down, I don't think that's the way.
No, that's not what I'm saying. That's not what I'm saying at all. You're saying okay, it's on the one hand, it's like personal decisions, life choices. And on the other hand, somehow the invisible hand of the market is sort of going to lead towards a virtual, instead of a vicious circle, which it seems to be happening to me, a virtual circle within capitalism itself that's going to change the system. I think those are both illusions those are magical thinking, I think. My point was that I think analysis matters, that how we actually understand the situation we're in. On the one hand, the real-time acceleration of climate change and how much time that actually gives us to make these changes, and like what time frame you proposing that this sort of magical switch is going to happen, and is that actually possible within the time frame that climate change itself, that geophysical processes are giving us? And on the other, is the capitalist, is your analysis of capitalism actually the correct one? Well, we got another couple callers. Looks like we got Brian, and hello.
Hi, thanks, Paul.
Okay, thank you, Harvey.
Okay, bye-bye.
Brian, go ahead, you're on the air.
Yeah, no, I think we sort of live in a time that we're defining sort of our own perspectives on the next steps that we need to take as a society, as a person, as a people, by not what we're necessarily for as a solution or a set of solutions, but what we're against. And that's, I think, very indicative of just the state of things right now with, where our own government has trended, where, Brazil's government has trended, where, as you very well articulated, the state of things internationally. I think our challenge is not to lose sight of what those solutions actually are in sort of a concrete set of actions that can be taken, whether that's, collective organizing, whether that's activism. But I think ultimately we need a solution, a set of replacements for the system that we're currently living under, which you're describing and articulating as the problem. Well, then, I guess, Paul, my question for you is, what is the solution and a very concrete replacement for the system that we currently live in? So I think that's the challenge, and I think a way to move forward is maybe exploring and having some speakers and a set of conversations around specific examples where people are currently living that model that is going to work and that will hopefully get us out of this mess. The challenge is that right now that's not talked about, and I think KBOO, as much as I love KBOO, we need that to be a model for a place where we can have conversations about that.
Okay, well, thank you. You could have proposed your own. Well, I had Victor Wallace on a few weeks ago. He talked about the red-green revolution, the politics and technology of eco-socialism. I think this is if there's a book that attempts to do what you're doing, like that builds upon, the Marxist tradition and other traditions in terms of a real analysis of the history and origins of capitalism. I think this is an interesting one. I personally think that it's even deeper than that. I think that it goes back, you know, really to the origins of civilization itself, and sort of the breakdown of the basic kinship, small face-to-face kinship, community system, which I think provided the kind of checks and balances on the rise of individual egoism and power grabbing. I think that those kind of, so is it possible to, that's why, you know, so-called primitivism or anti-civilization thought has sort of been so marginalized, because of course you can't go back to that, but are there aspects of that kind of those kind of so-called tribal or a small kinship community kind of sociology or psychology that you can actually attempt to recreate within, you know, a broader type of moving in the direction, you know, because I think socialism, you know, if you look at Marx, I mean, his trajectory was from so-called primitive communism through, you know, the archaic state, through feudalism, through capitalism. You know, there's argument whether that was sort of a historic determinism, whether, you know, we had to do that. You know, a lot of indigenous scholars dispute the idea that this sort of this inevitability of these stages, that actually, you know, indigenous people actually had a sustainable and have where they're able to still practice it, a way of life. But, you know, there's the concept of capitalist encirclement that militates against whether it's a nation state model like Cuba or other, you know, socialist models. It's a big subject. Yes, I think we do need to talk about this. I hope, you know, the Democratic Socialists of America are having these conversations. I welcome them to come on the show and talk about that. I certainly don't pretend to have an answer or the answer. I think some form, within what we have, this alienated mass society, some form of larger scale structures are going to be needed. We can't, you know, just devolve into, you know, small scale hunter-gatherer society. That might be the apocalyptic reality if, you know, things keep going the way they are. We may not have any choices at a certain point. So, yeah, I think, you know, collective movement building on a municipal, I think the idea of, you know, municipal, whatever, the Bookchinism, I think that provides some clues. There's a lot of ideas out there. There's maybe no one solution. But anyway, we've got someone who calls himself Symbol, who's waiting to...
Yeah, no, you're on the right track. What's going on here is you're looking at a basic pathopsychology of the individual. When the gods left Olympus, where did they go? They were put on the shoulders of individuals. We each have the powers of the gods now, and so we must now look to solve our deepest, most pressing complexes on our own. Okay, the institutions that you keep talking about and everybody keeps trying to fix are actually illusionary. Okay, you're on a rock flying through space with a bunch of parasitic, we're part of a parasitic race that think we're very, very pretty. We think we're very pretty. We think we're very beautiful. We are parasites. We're fracking the earth. We're fracking Gaia. Okay? We're a parasite on Gaia. Okay?
So you take the idealist position as opposed to the materialist.
Let me explain. The United States is not real. Okay? Ethnocentrism isn't real. We were told this. We were sold a bill of goods that is all a lie. Okay? There's no Canada, United States.
No,
let me say one more thing. Okay. One more thing. I respect the borders only because there are guns and power, and people are trying to solve their complexes using power and fear. That's all that's happening. What we need to do is go into our communities and start building mind maps of the people that we are actually going to help. The only way to stop the collective tumor of religion on the collective subconscious is to work from the inside out and find those people that are hurting and help them repair their own complexes. Okay, that's the only way it's going to happen.
Well, that sounds like it seems to be a version of binary. I would say that's a version of binary thinking, sort of that it has to be inside out. I think it actually, my view is it has to be a combination of inside out and outside in. And I don't think those things are exclusive. I think the idea that nation states and institutions are only illusion, I think that is an illusion itself. I think that they are.
Absolutely not. The thing is that I can redefine it any my reality any way I want, you see. You know, the problem is that what you say is that, you know, we have to go in and we have to learn what it is that we really believe, what our true work is. That's the problem with America, is we look so far out of ourselves, we don't find our true work inside. That's the magnetism in the magnet for you that'll draw people to you, make them interested in you for who you really are. Okay, we don't spend time in America teaching that. And the really crucial point is the social structure of the nuclear family. A marriage is a dyad. It's two people. Triads are the building blocks of culture. You will never build a culture. False premise. You will never build a culture with a dyad. You will never build it. It's going to be, you're going to keep everyone isolated. You're going to get community from communicating in a deeper, more collective way. And that is why people of power are able to separate and divide. That is it, period. Really.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your point of view. I do think there's actually a lot to what you're saying. I think it needs to be part of a broader conversation, so I appreciate your calling in. I'm not sure dyad or triad. As I said, I think it's a, you know, the idea that these small kinship-based communities were, you know, roughly 50 to 100, 200 members. I think that's actually the evolutionary, I hate to say it, this is a kind of a dirty word these days, norm. That's the evolutionary norm, and that's why, you know, we tend to be able to limit ourselves to, like, knowing well, you know, a limited, that sort of number of people. There's sort of psychological studies that have been done. Anyway, I think this is a challenging thoughts, and I hope Paul has some further interesting thoughts to add to our conversation. Go ahead.
Hey, how's it going? Yeah, I am on my way to work as a social worker for a homeless veterans center here in Portland. I've got a piece on Counterpunch that came out Monday, mental health crisis, housing crisis. Uh-huh. And, you know, I write a lot too, but it's really, there's insanity here. The language that I'm hearing in the last, you know, 40 minutes, it's the language of what Susan Sontag said in 74 in the Paris Review, that, you know, the white race is a cancer. And, you know, I'm 61, and we don't have indigenous voices here at KBOO today talking about the majority of the earth is indigenous, and it's white people coming up with these bizarre ideas of what tribalism is. And
what are you critiquing specifically?
I wish we would have a different dialogue.
You're saying that you're criticizing something. I wish it'd be more concrete and specific.
This is the This is the language of your show, Paul. You know, Paul. Have a good day.
No, you don't want to respond specifically. Then okay, that's fine. That's fine. If you don't want to actually engage in a conversation, then we don't have to. Okay, we got other callers, 503-231-8187. Go ahead, Mark, you're on the air.
Hi, Paul. I think it was a French socialist, Juan Juarez, who said that capitalism contains crisis as rain clouds contain rain. I appreciate your program, and we need to face the structural questions that the corporate media destroys or denies. The Vienna Housing Fund buys up property and prevents speculation. The rents in Vienna are half the rents in Munich. So I think this is a great example. We don't need sophisticated theory. We just need an example that works and that can lead us out of this crisis of boutique hotels.
Uh-huh.
I think, you know, Portland and the downtown area is just bursting with boutique hotels as if there were no alternatives. And of course, we need SROs, single resident occupancy, which are far better than prisons or warehouses. They are forms of community, and yet for some reason they're not part of the discourse. So
how about capitalism itself?
Well, we're witnessing the self-destruction. You know, when economic power becomes political power, and the casino owner, who's a bankrupt, chronic liar, makes everything uncertain, you know, and denies the reality, the necessity of taxes, and of checks and balances. So, in thinking that the birthright citizenship can be ruled out, it might be an impeachable offense. So I'm looking forward to the landslide or the blue wave because he has turned the stomachs of the people. So I'm hoping the people will, I'm hoping the votes will be counted. You know, as a jaded ex-San Franciscan, I'm very cynical about the way we count the votes. Sometimes we save money just by counting only the Republican votes.
Mm-hmm.
But thanks for your energy and your passion. And try to do research on the Vienna Housing Fund. That could bring us out of our, you know, terrible inequality.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you very much for calling
thank
in.
You. Okay.
The Vienna Housing Fund. It's interesting you mentioned Vienna because one of the articles I was thinking of reading was Is Capitalism a Threat to Democracy? Talks about Hungarian intellectual Karl Polanyi and actually his time in Vienna at the between the First World War and the Second World War, and how there was actually a socialist government, so-called Red Vienna, when the city's socialist government was providing apartments for the working class and opening new libraries and kindergartens. Polanyi held informal seminars on socialist economics at home. He started writing for the anyway. It goes on and it talks about how then of course the Red Vienna was overturned because of the contradictions within the capitalist system. So yeah, I mean, I think all these temporary solutions, which are great solutions, I'm not saying, you know, all this stuff's great. The, you know, the carbon tax, the initiative, the green economic initiatives, all this stuff is good, but they're temporary. They don't actually address the internal contradictions of the capitalist system, which are continuing to propel us to disaster. But we've got Tammy. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. I was just listening to the show, and I think that it's great that you're highlighting all of the negative effects of capitalism, but just to kind of piggyback on the caller beforehand when he mentioned kind of pontificating over something, yet not actually giving voice to people who have been hurt by capitalism, which for the most part would be indigenous, people of color, immigrants, and other people like that. So I think he had mentioned people are speaking this language, the language of the white man, that isn't expressing the feelings, whether it's the indigenous opinion or the either minority opinion, which are the people that are hurt the most from capitalism. I think maybe that's what the caller was talking about beforehand. So
right.
I was just felt maybe clearing that out. And being a woman of color myself, I think that, capitalism is definitely terrible. It hurts a lot of people. It can help, but not in the sense of longevity. It can help for the moment, as far as just making money, and, you know, the outcome of it is always going to be, unfortunately, the earth is going to suffer from it. Communities are going to suffer from it. But right now, there are communities that are suffering from it, and it'll be maybe more useful to try and help them as opposed to, kind of talk about how socialism can help, because, I don't know, the communities can help each other a little bit more. I don't know. You know what I mean? Like, we shouldn't really rely on a government who used to enslave people to help us come out of mental or financial slavery. You know what I mean?
I'm not sure I do, actually, because I guess my point was that actually, and it may be wrong, but I don't know if anybody's actually refuted, is that there's a that we're heading very rapidly towards total annihilation. And so I think if we're not, then, you know, great, we have lots of time to work everything out. But if we are, so I guess my point is, are we or aren't we heading towards climate catastrophe in our real time? And are we or are we not heading toward, on a global scale, heading towards more authoritarian, more vicious forms of capitalism as an inherent dynamic of the capitalist system? So I think it's either true or false, and I think we need to resolve those questions. And sure, I'm acknowledged being a privileged white male, but that doesn't necessarily mean that my analysis is flawed. I think I'm putting out ideas that people can critique or not, you know, agree with or not.
Yeah, no, just because someone has more privilege than another person doesn't mean their opinion should totally be canceled out at all. It's just that there are different, the way that it affects you could affect someone else who is, like, per se, a homeless veteran on a different scale. So there are different scales to this, and it's how, in annihilation, I don't know. I mean, obviously there are proof to the fact that the world is changing as far as its climate and all. But I think those are, like, two different topics, and maybe combining them together can be just a little confusing, you know? I definitely do agree with you that capitalism is hurting us as a collective society of just humans, and it's kind of inorganic to make people live in a capitalistic form of way. But I have a lot of hope for the next generation, honestly. I see young people taking such initiative that it really makes me think that, wow, when I was there, I was not thinking this broad, you know, this big, this broad. And I don't know, just how do we reach education? How do we get people more educated to not be wasteful, to recycle, to do all these different things? You know, someone mentioned electric cars. Well, great, but I can't afford an electric car. I don't know anyone of people that I am with that can afford an electric car, or, you know, can afford a greenhouse, or can afford all these different means of, and, you know, other capitalistic means of quote unquote saving the planet. I can't afford a better wash, you know, a better dishwasher. I can't afford that. I can't afford all the capitalistic means to save the world. What I can do is offer my time, you know, offer myself. So,
well, Kathy,
hopefully that's good enough, right?
Yeah, as unfortunately so often happens, I think we're getting into the meat of the conversation, but we're at the very end of the program. This seems to be a dynamic, but I thank you for calling in. I don't know, Kathy's been waiting too. Kathy, do you have a quick contribution to the show? I'm really sorry, but we're just about out of time.
Sure, yeah. Another great show, thanks. I wanted to say that the essential crisis that we're in is one of time. And we have sort of, you know, we have things that we need to do as an emergency, and then we have a long-term vision. And I place the idea of transfer to socialism and that conversation as the long-term that we need to continually be working towards. But in the short term, we need to do things that will dial down the carbon and other greenhouse gas emissions. And that would mean going back to the old boring drive less, eat less meat and dairy, this reducing our consumption.
I agree.
On the short term,
I think we have to
and going with how also really aligning ourselves with nature and how.
Okay, great, Kathy. We got to go. We're at the end of the program. Sorry, right. I appreciate your calling. And next time, call half an hour earlier. This is Paul Rowland, Wednesday Talk Radio. Stay tuned for Lisa Loving and Political Perspectives.
Herbspear is wagging his finger. Marx is scratching his head. They ought to be shooting the bankers, but they're giving them money instead. Catnip should be storming the ramparts and whetting the guillotine's blade, singing capitalism's in crisis. So where are the barricades? Why don't they close down?
KBOO Camino Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Dia de los Muertos celebration on Friday, November 2nd from noon to 10 p.m. at St. Andrew's Church in Portland. This is the 10-year anniversary of the celebration of Dia de los Muertos in Portland. There will be altar building,
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Vote Together Portland. March to the ballot box on Thursday, November 1st from 6 to 8 p.m. at Dig a Pony in Portland. Join the Bus Project for a trip to the ballot box and a party to celebrate voting. Vote Together will meet at Dig a Pony at 6 p.m., then march up to the ballot box for red carpet voting, music, and more. Ballots are due on November 6th. Again, that's Vote Together Portland, March to the Ballot Box on Thursday, November 1st from 6 to 8 p.m. at Dig a Pony, 736 Southeast Grand Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.